Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy. I'm pleased to bring to you the first Mishnah in the fourth parak of Bava Metziah for OU's Shnayim Mishnah program. And in this Mishnah, there are two principles at play. The first is that buying movable goods with money, i.e. coins, does not seal the transaction. So, if someone bought, let's say, a storeroom of, 100 pounds of wool, and you pay the seller for his wool, the wool does not become yours when you give him the cash. It only becomes yours after you do a pickup of the wool. There is a question of whether this is true from the Torah, that is, whether the Torah requires that the items actually be moved, or whether the rabbis require this because it forces the seller to take care of the goods until the pickup is made. For instance, let's say the seller takes the cash and then says, okay, go to the warehouse and go pick up your goods. And then there's a fire at the warehouse and the seller's like, well, I don't care, I already got the cash. So it's possible that it's a rabbinic rule. In fact, that's the way Rav Bartnura holds. But right now, it really won't make a difference. The bottom line is handing over the money is not good enough to essentially acquire movable goods. There's another principle which is important to understand, which is that there is a second type of way one can acquire goods besides giving cash, and that is by using a barter system, or goods exchanged for goods. So what that means is, let's say you are trading 100 pounds of wool for 100 pounds of tomatoes. So what happens is, as soon as you grab one person's item, then he immediately acquires your items, or vice versa. If you grab somebody's tomatoes and you've made a deal that you're trading the tomatoes for the wool, he automatically acquires the wool, even though he hasn't taken possession. The transaction does take place immediately. So once again, cash for goods, the transaction doesn't take place immediately when the cash is handed over, but goods for goods, the transaction does take place right after the first goods are taken possession of. Now, there's one other important thing, especially that's confusing in modern times, which is that coins in the olden days, and even not so much in the olden days, they're not just statements of owing somebody a certain amount of money. They actually have a real intrinsic money. They actually have a value. For instance, even going back to the 1960s, the United States, if you take a look at a quarter, if you turn a quarter on its side and look on it at the edge, if it was printed or minted before 1964, so what you'll see is that it's silver. If you look at one from, I think it's 1964, maybe 1965, and afterwards you'll see it's made out of copper, which means it's not worth 25 cents at all, or it's not worth whatever that amount of silver is. It's simply copper, and it's plated, I think, with nickel. So everybody knows that paper bills aren't real money. They say, in God we trust, but it's really in, man, I hope the government doesn't fall apart and will pay me back the cash at some point. And the truth is, even then, every dollar that was printed had to be backed up first by gold and now by silver, and now it's just backed up by the trust that one has in one's government. So everybody understands that a paper bill has no intrinsic value. It's just essentially a debt statement, a statement of promise from the issuer. Coins, however, used to be, and certainly in ancient times when the Mishnah is being written, have an actual intrinsic value. They're worth what the metal weight is. Well, actually, they have two things which affect their value. One is the metal weight, that is the type of metal and how much metal there is in a coin. So an ounce of silver, a half ounce of gold, 3 ounces of copper, whatever it is, it has a certain intrinsic value because of the weight of metal. And in addition, it also has a value because of the image that's stamped on it, which gets back more into the reliability issue and perhaps the collectability issue as well. Also, when a coin, therefore, actually, as it goes through its transactions, it gets rubbed away a little bit, people are careful with it, because not only you rubbing away the face of the coin, which guarantees that it's printed with good quality metal, assuming that you know the person or the face that's printed on it, but it means that some of the metal has been rubbed away as well, and therefore the coin weighs less than its stated value, and therefore has less of an intrinsic value. So coins back in the old days actually had an intrinsic value, but they still are not considered movable goods. And therefore, the Mishnah says, "Hazahav koneh et hakesef, v'hakesef eino koneh et hazahav." If you're buying silver coins with your own golden coins, you take possession of the silver coins as soon as the seller of the silver takes your gold coins. That is, it acts as a chalipin, as a barter, and not as a purchase of cash. And that's because the gold coins, compared to the silver coins you're purchasing, are not are very rarely used in simple cash transactions. As you, nobody walks around with gold in their pocket waiting to purchase a cup of soda or a Häagen-Dazs ice cream. They're used very, very carefully. And in comparison to silver coins, they should not be treated as cash at all. The silver coins are treated as cash, but the gold are considered goods, collectibles, whatever you want to say, but they're no longer really considered goods. So, therefore, the transaction is considered chalipin, it's considered bartering, and as soon as the person takes your, let's say, 5 gold pieces, you get his 100 silver coins right away, even though you did not actually go to his silver coin warehouse and take possession by pulling them, packing them up, or putting them in your pocket. Now, this is not just a question of the gold being worth more than the silver. It's the fact that gold is simply a less common means of purchasing items via coins, and therefore it must be treated as goods, not coins, and compared to the silver, which is why the next case is true as well. The nechoshet, which is either copper or bronze. Bronze is simply copper with a little bit of tin put in, but when the Torah says nechoshet and the Mishnah says nechoshet, it's not clear whether it's copper or bronze, but we'll go with copper. Hanechoshet koneh takesef. That is, if you give somebody your bronze coins or your copper coins, that does immediately take possession, and you're purchasing somebody else's silver coins, that immediately takes possession. Now you may say, oh, wait a second, nechoshet is much cheaper, copper coins are much cheaper than the silver coins, so maybe it's the silver coins that should be considered the goods and not the copper coins. But it happens to be that silver is the most common form of coinage. People just take silver more than they take bronze. Back in the old days, bronze was probably more like a medallion than anything else. You simply couldn't get enough of them to really do a lot of purchases. Silver was the classic purchase item, and therefore if you were paying with copper, the copper was such an unusual coinage, or a less usual coinage than silver, so therefore the copper is considered the goods compared to the silver, which is still considered the cash, and therefore if you give somebody as soon as they take your bronze or copper coins, you immediately acquire his silver even though you haven't picked it up yet. But if you give the guy your silver coins to buy his bronze/copper coins, that does not take place right away. The transaction does not take place right away until you go and pick up the bronze, because Kesef, even though it's more expensive than the Choshet, is a more common coin, and it's treated as a coin rather than as a good. Ma'ot ra'ot, which are worn-out coins, probably the face has been rubbed away, konot et yafot, so they serve as chalipin, they serve as goods to immediately acquire coins that still have their face value, that still have the image on the coin. And that's because ma'ot ra'ot simply aren't used much. People don't take them because if the image is rubbed away, I can't tell who printed it. If I can't tell who printed it, I don't know whether it's a solid 5 ounces of gold or silver or whatever, or if somebody put a lot of bogus metal in there, a lot of impure metal, and that it's not worth what it appears to be. And therefore, since it's not used commonly without a face, once it loses its face, and therefore once it gets rubbed away, it no longer is used as pure cash, therefore it's treated as goods, and as soon as a person takes it from you, it's like chalipin, and you immediately acquire his good coins, his coins that still have the face value on them. But the other way doesn't work. If you have coins, if you're the one with the coins with the face value, and you're purchasing ones that have been rubbed away, it's the coins themselves are treated as coins, as face value. They are used for purchases, and therefore it's not until you go pick up the material that the deal is done. And an asimon, which is a coin that's, it's interesting, in Israel an asimon was the stuff that used to put into the old telephones. It had a little hole in the middle that you would hang on a string or a necklace or whatever it is. But an asimon here is one that's created without an image whatsoever. I forget what they're called, the coins that are simply like these discs of the metal. So they're koneh tamatbeah, because they're uncommonly used for actual trading, because you have to really know your stuff to know whether it really is worth the amount of metal that it appears to be worth. Therefore, they act as a goods, and therefore the transaction is chalipin. And as soon as the person takes your asimon, your faceless coin, you immediately acquire somebody's faced coin. Whether that faced coin has been rubbed away a little bit or whether it hasn't been rubbed away, it's not an issue. In comparison with the asimon, it is considered cash compared to the asimon, which is considered goods. But the other way does not work, hamat beyar. So, but if you have a coin which either does have an image or has a partially wiped away image, that does not immediately cause a transaction to acquire somebody's asimons, and therefore you have to actually go and pick up the asimons and move them or package them in order to make the acquisition. And now we get to, essentially, the Mishnah rolls up with two overarching principles, which I mentioned at the very beginning. Metaltalin, which are movable goods, konim et matbeya. If a person takes some metaltalin from you, that's chalipin, and you immediately get whatever he was selling you, whether it was more metaltalin, whether it was other goods, or whether it is actual coins. Hamatbeya, however, eino konim et matbeya. However, if you have a coin, you give somebody a coin, no coin will ever cause an immediate transaction of actual goods. You have to go and get the actual goods in order for the transaction to be complete. Zaklal, this is an overarching principle. Kol ha-metaltalin konin zeh. And of course, if you have one goods traded for another set of goods, like tomatoes for leather shoes, that transaction takes place right away, regardless of who grabs whose goods first. And now on to Mishnah Bet, which explains the situation that we've just been discussing. Ketzad, how does this all work? Mashachemenu peirot velo natan lo maot eino yachol atzor bo. So if a person purchased fruit for cash and he pulled the fruit, which means he either lifted it or moved it or boxed it up or what have you, even though he has not given over the cash, the deal is done. That is, the moving of a movable item causes a transaction to take place regardless of whether the items are paid for with cash at this point or not. Neither party could back out. Natan lo ma'ot, if the person gave him cash, velo mashach hemenu peirot, but he did not go and actually move the movable items, yachol achzor bo, either party could back out, which means the person that you gave the money to could say, take your money back, I don't want it, and the person who gave the money could say, give me back my money, I don't want those things. Again, whether that's d'oraita from the Torah or drabanan is a separate issue, but that's the bottom line. Now, you may be saying to yourself, oh, that's creepy, I gave the guy cash, and now I'm going to take the cash back because I changed my mind. So, Aval Amru, but they said, meaning the Chachamim said, Misha Parama Anshe Dora Mabul Umidora Vlaga, Hu Atili Parami Mishaino Omei Bidiburo. The one who called in the payment for the generation of the flood, means he punished them, and the generation of the disbursement, meaning the ones who built the Tower of Bavel, he, meaning God, of course, should extract payment, figuratively, of course, from one who doesn't keep his verbal contract. Now, the Mishnah here says verbal contract, but I don't think that it doesn't mean purely verbal. I think the meaning here is that verbal plus you gave over the cash. I mean, if I just tell you, oh, I love your tomatoes and I'll promise to give you $2 tomorrow, that does not really contractually bind you, and I doubt that the rabbis are asking for that God should be porea, that God should figuratively make the guy pay for it in one way or the other. I think the case here is where you make not only the verbal agreement, but a cash has changed hands, and then one of the two parties says, you know what, never mind. In that case, the Chachamim say that God will get involved in that one way or the other. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Kol Sha Kesef Yado, Yado Al Yonah. So Rabbi Shimon disagrees and says, whoever has cash in his hand has the advantage. Now, the simple reading of this is that Rabbi Shimon disagrees that cash has no immediate transactional value, that everything that we've essentially said for a Mishnah and a half is not true, and that once the seller of the goods has cash in hand, which means the buyer is given over the cash, even though he hasn't gone and moved the goods, while the seller can give the guy the money back, the purchaser can't say, hey, give me my money back. The one with the cash in his hands is the one with the advantage, or as the Mishnah says, Yado al Eliona. Rabbi Barnura, however, says Rabbi Shimon is actually talking about a much narrower case, because Rabbi Barnura believes that the whole reason why cash doesn't actually work for it to immediately invoke a transaction is rabbinic. And as I mentioned before, the situation is that if the seller takes the cash and the transaction goes right away, and then the seller has a warehouse full of goods and there's a fire in the warehouse, so he's not going to be bother himself to try to put out the fire and save the goods because they belong to somebody else now. So Rabbi Bar-Nura says that the case that we're talking about here is a case where the warehouse where the seller has stored his goods is actually being borrowed, is rented out from the purchaser. And therefore, the purchaser will certainly look out over his own goods, and the rabbinic restriction on cash being an immediate transactor in business doesn't apply, and therefore, only in that case does cash make an immediate deal, but otherwise cash does not make an immediate deal. But of course, as I said, it's possible that Rabbi Shimon simply disagrees with the entire principle that cash, that if once cash is given, you can then cancel the deal in any case.